Howdy there, friends, and thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives. That's right, folks, it's me, Cam Hale, and as always, joining me, I guess the crunch to my celery sitting across the table over here, Mr. Kyle Filson. Brud, what is going on?
Not much, man, just living the dream.
Right? Is it a dream?
Just working along. Sometimes it feels more like a nightmare. But yeah, I'm doing okay. I'm glad to be here. I like being back in studio. I love doing the show, and I'm excited to talk about the topics that we're going to discuss.
I had a really interesting week, if you will. We had at work a large inspection from the TCEQ, the Texas Commission of Environmental Quality. Okay?
Yeah.
And they come in, and they do an inspection on all of our paperwork and all of our stuff. And it's very, very stressful. You know, you want to make sure you got all your stuff in line, the whole deal. And I had three ladies riding with me that came in from the state. And I found out that all three of those ladies like podcasts. And not only that, they're going to sign up and listen to our podcast.
Really?
Yeah. So it is Crystal, Megan, and Tamara is who I spent time with. So, ladies, if you're listening, thanks so much for coming over. Thanks so much for not putting the crush on me and making it hard on me. And I'm glad all my stuff was in order. But, yeah, look, I had a great time. It was a stressful week. I'm glad that's done. Now we're going to get to have a little fun, my friend.
Yeah, it does seem like podcasts are starting to become more and more mainstream,
it does.
Right?
Yeah, it really does. Yeah.
Yeah, pretty cool.
I've got you something here. Remember now, on the Wednesday show, on the Elite show, look, we talked about some drone activity. I've got another drone thing I'm going to bring up here, folks. This is for all of our family over in the UK. Heads up, you might want to put on a helmet, folks. Amazon is expanding drone delivery testing in the UK. The company wants to test automated drone fleets, folks.
Wow. So like on the last fleets. Show, on the Elite show, I think it was, you were talking about how the drone delivered a Slurpee.
And a hot dog.
And a hot dog. And
chili
dog. For the first time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
This is going to become real.
Well, right now, Amazon's partnering with the British government. Now, folks, you go to TheVerge.com, you can check this out. But they're doing this partnership to expand its testing of delivery drones, and they believe it's going to pave the way for commercial air deliveries there in the UK for its residents. And this expanded testing was announced in a press release on the 25th, and it involves Amazon working with the UK Civil Aviation Authority, says to focus on operating drones outside of the line of sight of pilots, improving sensors for obstacle detection and avoidance, and having one pilot operate a team of multiple semi-autonomous drones in unison.
Whoa.
Yeah, that's what they're looking for. Now, this is it. It's called, the project is the latest regulatory victory for Prime Air. This is the online retailer's ambitious program designed to bring cheaper and more forward-thinking delivery logistics in-house. Now, Paul Meisner's Amazon VP of Global Innovation Policy and Communications. That dude's business card must be long as a well rope.
Right.
So this is what he had to say. The UK is a leader in enabling drone innovation. We have been investing in prime air research and development here for quite some time. This announcement strengthens our partnership with the UK and brings Amazon closer to our goal of using drones to safely deliver parcels in 30 minutes to customers in the UK and elsewhere around the world. So that's what they're going on. And also, I didn't even realize this, but Amazon has been putting a lot of pressure on the FAA because they're trying to get them to loosen up its drone testing restrictions.
That's insane. I mean, how's it going to work? Because it's also going to be based on how big of a package you're trying to have delivered,
yes.
Right? I mean, there's got to be some kind of regulation because a drone can only carry so much.
I'm sure, like you're saying, I'm sure starting out there's going to be size limits to what you can have delivered locally and stuff like that. But how long before you have drones that are the size of let's say 4x8 sheets of plywood?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Where they're real large, just boom, it's just
but
noise.
How annoying
in the air.
Is it gonna be to see that much stuff in the sky all day, every day? You know what I mean?
Extremely annoying. But here's it's the give and take. People are always complaining about delivery trucks and 18-wheelers and all this stuff in your way too. Well, where do you want it? On the ground or do you want it in the air? Because I will say this, if it's in the air and if it's all electric, it will be cleaner energy.
Yeah, I agree with that.
But what about when they crash? Will they just you to lose your package? You know what I mean? If it just lands in somebody's backyard and all that.
Well, like you were talking about on Thursday's show, like what if somebody's like out in their yard and they see something and they're shooting the drones down and taking the
exactly
the package?
I'm sure they'll have locators in it, and if it lands in a yard, it's just kind of like stealing someone's mail and things along those lines. There's hurdles to get over. I like the idea of some of this stuff, but I want there to be limits. Like we talked about, medical supplies. I'm okay with medical supplies. I'm okay if you're trying to rush deliver, you know, anything from, you know, like we talked about medicine or anything from one hospital to the next,
right,
or
yeah,
something along those lines. I'm okay with that. But just to have a movie delivered to your house from Redbox, or just so you can get a Slurpee and a chili dog because you're too lazy to get up and go eat it yourself. Yeah. I have a problem with that flying around in my sky.
That's a little ridiculous.
Yeah.
Well, moving on, there's an interesting article by Andrew Lapin over the National Geographic News, and it's about, could what happened in Fukushima happen 35 miles north of New York City?
Whoa. Is it? You're telling me there's a nuclear reactor there?
Yeah. And what they're saying is many activists and awesome former nuclear regulators fear for the Indian Point Energy Center, which is a nuclear power plant that has operated in Westchester County for more than 4 decades. This plant provides a good chunk of the energy needs for the surrounding area, but it has recently come under fire for safety and environmental concerns, including its warming of the Hudson River.
Oh, that sounds awesome.
And there's even been a recent case of bolts missing in one of its reactors. Now, two of the plant's 3 reactor units are currently operating on expired licenses with the state of New York, having denied the parent company, Entergy's, extension request due to suspected violations of the Federal Clean Water Act. In a new documentary named Indian Point, currently in select theaters, filmmaker Ivy Mirapol uses the plant to get into both sides of the nuclear debate. Now, Mirapol, who's also a director on the upcoming second season of the National Geographic Channel series, Years of Living Dangerously, tours both the Indian Point and Fukushima. She profiles plant workers and executives, along with anti-nuclear activists, environmental nonprofits, and a former chairman of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Now, she says that seeing the inner workings of the plant was a little bit reassuring. Mirapol still found many disturbing details, though. She said, all these people who work in the nuclear power plant, basically, their main job is just to make sure that nothing goes terribly wrong. She spoke to a National Geographic about a recent journey to the central reactor on this nuclear debate. And the debate basically is why nuclear power plants, and if they do, put aquatic wildlife in any danger, and just how scared New Yorkers should be about this Indian Point plant. Now, National Geographic asked Ivy to describe her experience you had when she stepped into the Indian Point reactor for the first time with her camera. And she said, the first time, the owners of Indian Point were only allowing me to film a typical tour that any school group can go on, or politicians. It's a very controlled situation where they bring you just to a few parts of the plant and you don't really get to go to the radioactive side. That wasn't what I was looking for. As a documentary filmmaker, I wanted to go deeper, and I wanted access to areas that not everyone else can typically see. And after I kept pushing, calling the communications department saying, what I really want is for you to introduce me to someone who has worked there for a long time, I was eventually able to convince them, and their side never gets to the part that never gets seen. Now, there's a lot of films about nuclear power, and they're all about trying to shut them down. Personally, she said, I found myself kind of giddy. It was a strange experience. Like, I can't believe I'm so excited to go into a nuclear power plant. Now, National Geographic went on to ask Ivy, what was the most surprising things you learned about the nuclear industry or nuclear regulation in the United States? And she went on to say that plants in general get an original 40-year license to operate, and then they have to reapply for another 20 years. And what I found surprising was how limited the scope was and what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission looks at to decide whether or not if they can be relicensed. All of these issues that the public is concerned about, like whether you can evacuate or not, is ridiculous. She said 20 million people live in the danger zone around Indian Point, and there's just no way to evacuate. So we have an evacuation route signs that are posted everywhere, but they're not real. Anyone knows, with all the traffic and stuff in the tri-state area, you could not evacuate everybody in a safe and certain amount of time.
There's no way.
And they say that this is just some of the stuff that has to do with relicensure. They have to make sure that you have an evacuation plan to get your new license. But it's a joke. Nobody
can't do
it.
You can with drones.
It's kind of ignored. She said it seems kind of crazy to me. And there's many other things that they keep relicensing these plants in hopes that no one really pays attention. But it looks like there could be a problem. And if there's a problem, I mean, you're talking about 35 miles north of New York City, a real problem.
Well, it gets to be the habit, just the ongoing thing of, like you're talking about, the licensing, is that's just what you do. You know, these people are running a business. It employs tons of people. It makes the state a lot of money. Let's just go ahead and license them and keep them going. And that seems to be like what they're going through now. But like you're talking about, it's one thing to license somebody and keep them going. You know, if they've got a car wash and they're not emptying out their sand traps, and you've got to, you know, you kind of get in some trouble off and on for that. It's a whole nother thing whenever they're running a shoddy ran. And I don't know if it's shoddy. I'm just, you know, throwing it out there, folks. I'm not accusing them of anything. But if they're running a shoddy ran nuclear reactor, that's not what we need, especially up there. I mean, like you're talking about, you can't, how would you enact any sort of escape plan whatsoever for, like I said, drones is a joke, but that would be the only thing. It's almost like escape modules. Imagine backpack drones. When it goes crazy, you clip them on and just
yeah, like, but the they Jetsons. Don't have that. That's the problem. And they said when the plant first started, since that time, there's been numerous more people that have moved in the surrounding area. And part of being able to renew your license is you have to have an evacuation plan. But everybody knows it's a joke.
Yeah, that's
it's not gonna. They said one of the things you have to get your license renewed is you have to have like a loud siren to warn people around the area that there's a problem or a meltdown. But even if you hear the siren, you can't get away in time.
You hear how antiquated that is? How silly that sounds.
I know, right?
Hey, everybody! There's a massive amount of radiation over here just from a siren. You're like, look, this isn't 1950. Bang! Where they crank the horn? No, bud. No.
She goes on to say that it's as long as you get your paperwork in on time and there's no glaring problem, you're basically going to get relicensed. That's it. They just move along, people.
Dude, that's not cool. That's not cool.
Yeah, it's pretty scary.
I got you something that's pretty scary, if you want to talk about that. This just comes from Lon over at Phantoms and Monsters, and he's working on this, and he posted this last week about an upright wolf encounter, Kyle, at Homer's Gap.
Oh, I like those. Yeah.
And he says he was actually talking to the guy from a phone call from a dude, and the guy's 36 years old from Altoona, and he said that it happened back in the summer of 1998. He said the location of the encounter was an area known as Homer's Gap, which is located in the township, the Logan Township, in Blair County. It says he and another man were traveling west on Homer's Gap Road, approximately 2 miles from the turnoff onto Homer's Gap Road from Grandview Road. And as they were in a wooded residential area, they noticed something standing on the side of the road.
Yikes.
Right? Nothing. You're like, what is that? Somebody. So as they slowed down, it says the light from a nearby residence illuminated an 8 to 9 foot upright wolf. They described it as looking as the same as the lichens in the movie Underworld.
Oh, my God. Have you seen that?
Yeah. It says a wolf-like head covered in black and brown matted hair, long muscular arms with human-like hands hanging down along the body. Says as they approached this beast, it immediately got down on all fours and sprinted across the road. It was then they noticed that it had large black human-like feet and hocked legs. The body had a huge chest and sparsely covered in hair, as well as a tapered body with muscular legs. The height of the back was higher than the vehicle's hood.
Oh, my God.
It says, as it crossed the road, it looked back at the vehicle, and that's when they noticed it had bright golden eyes. It said it crossed and moved into the woods, and the driver floored the vehicle, almost losing control. It says both witnesses have not talked about the encounter since.
Wow.
Yeah. Now, of course, now he goes on to say that this encounter is very similar to others that he's received throughout central Pennsylvania, in particular the area that we have designated as the Lichen Loop.
What?
That this sighting has been recorded into the Pennsylvania Upright Canine and Dogman Witness Sighting Map.
That is insane. I mean, there really are, though, a lot of sightings in Pennsylvania as well as Wisconsin.
Here's, I still, man, this damn thing. We go on, and I don't, like we said, I don't know what it is about. Oh, everybody believes Bigfoot. You don't want to be. There's getting to be more and more and more of these things.
That's what I always say. So, is there actually more of these sightings, or is it becoming
the
populace is becoming aware of dogman stories? So now they're starting to create.
But the same thing could be said about Bigfoot.
I agree.
I don't know, but it is a fascinating tale, and it's terrifying, but I knew you would like it because of you always bringing up the underworld. It's like, could you imagine seeing that? And when I saw that, I'm like, Kyle's going to love this because it's like an underworld werewolf standing on the side of the
road. I love werewolves, and I love werewolf movies.
Yeah, right? Are you going to wait? Before you get going, are you going to watch the remake of American Werewolf in London?
Absolutely not. It's a disgrace. It's a disgrace. One of my favorite beloved movies of all times, and they're going to remake American World from
London.
That's
what I've heard.
They're going to ruin it. They're going to ruin it.
I got him going.
The movie
now, folks,
is still good today. What is going on in Hollywood? Why can't you just make another werewolf movie? Why do you have to remake one that's already good? You know what I mean?
You ought to see him going crazy, folks.
Why don't you have American Werewolf in Cincinnati or American Werewolf in Bangkok or something? Don't rue American Werewolf in London. It's already been made, and it was perfect. Perfect.
Go on.
So then I use CGI or some garbage like that. It never looks the same.
I should have never brought it up.
The Howling and American Werewolf in London are the two greatest werewolf movies of all time. I don't care if you disagree. Moving on, but speaking of television, a flame of American 90s childhood went out on Tuesday with the death cam of Miss Cleo.
No, are you serious?
Do you remember the famous infomercial tarot card reading clairvoyant?
She's Jamaican.
Yeah, well, not really.
What?
You're going to hear more.
Don't you really want to know?
Okay,
don't you really want to know, Cam?
I was wondering who the father of my baby was.
All right, let's take a look. The Miss Cleo DNA test. I don't know. I'm solely searching for the father of your baby. Oh. It's the one that's very unpleasant, okay?
Okay.
And he's also the one that had another girlfriend while he was sleeping with you.
Yes, he did.
Yep, that's him. That's the daddy.
Okay.
But you knew that.
I wasn't sure.
I don't know how. The baby looked just like him.
Yes, he does.
Yeah, so you were in denial. Because he has a funny little chin, doesn't he?
Yes, he does.
Yeah, now that and when the you're baby have this, that.
Now when you're saying this, she doesn't sound that Jamaican now after I hear it.
Well, let me get to that part. Miss Cleo, whose real name is Uree Dell Cleo Millie Harris, she died in Palm Beach, Florida on Tuesday at the age of 53. And she had been battling colon cancer. Now, in the 1990s and the early 2000s, Harris's television ads, where she implored people to call me now for your free tarot reading, made her famous. And in those decades, it wasn't uncommon for celebrities, including Hulk Hogan, the New Kids on the Block, to call in
Ask Miss Cleo. Whoa, NKOTB was talking to Miss Cleo?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, she became a cultural phenomenon. She offered no-nonsense advice to those with relationship issues claiming to see the truth of what they were doing in her cards. And when a caller asked for guidance on whether to go out of town with a lover one time, Miss Cleo replied, "Who asked you to go out of town? The stupid young one or the married one?" And she said, "That's what I thought. Don't go, you hear me? I'm trying to help you avoid the heartache." They said the cards can reveal things that you've never seen yourself. Now, in 2002, the Federal Trade Commission filed a complaint against the Psychic Readers Network, the company that Harris worked for, claiming it had made, get this, Cam, $1 billion with deceptive advertising for claiming the calls were free. But Ms. Harris wasn't the owner of the company, so this lawsuit was dropped from her. Now, although Harris's patois accent was a critical part of her television persona, she later said that it was put on and that she was actually born in Los Angeles to a middle-class immigrant parent. She said, "I speak perfect English." And when you grow up in America and you have Caribbean background, your parents beat it into you that the only way to succeed is by dropping the patois.
Well, so she grew up with her parents were speaking like that.
Yeah. But
so she is from, like, basically from Jamaica.
Her parents were Caribbean, right?
Okay,
but she's not. You know
so that's
what I mean?
Why she could nail it. I got you.
Yeah.
Okay.
Now, despite, they say, being dubbed a clairvoyant, Harris also said she never claimed to be one. She said she instead studied voodoo under a Haitian mambo for 30 years. She said, "So they refer me to a psychic because the word voodoo scares just about everybody. They told me, don't say you know voodoo. Tell everybody that you're a psychic. We're going to call you that." And she said, "But I'm not a psychic." And that's what she told interviewers at Vice News. But anyway, she went on to do that. And everybody is familiar with that TV commercial. Don't you remember that? And she made a lot of money. Here's one of the shocking things, though. Not that she's not really Jamaican. Not that she's not psychic. She didn't know she had cancer.
The cards didn't tell her that.
It went undiagnosed, and she got to feeling bad one day and went to the hospital, checked in, and they you're eat up with colon cancer. And it wasn't very long after that she expired. So
I hate cancer.
I do too, but it also makes me always wonder, you know, how many times do you see where these psychics end up coming down with cancer or something? You're like, well, if you're really a medical intuitive, wouldn't you know that you had cancer?
Well, what I'm thinking too is, okay, let's just say this. What if it's real? All right. What if she did have some sort of ability, but over all this time of not, you know, she studied voodoo. She didn't study all this stuff. What if at some point she lost that ability because she didn't, you know, maybe it is a gift from wherever you want to take it. These people do have a gift, but if you don't stay true to that gift, it's just like playing a sport or doing anything else. You lose part of it or they take it away from you.
Yeah, well, that's definitely possible. Look, and I'm not poking fun at psychics, because even recently, me and Cam, we went and had a reading. Remember that?
Mm-hmm.
And I will say that some of the things that were brought up were pretty interesting.
Yes, very.
You know, I know everybody's like, well, tell us more. Tell us exactly what happened. I'd like to. But that's part of the whole thing. It would take too long. A lot of it was personal and private. But I will say, I have met people that seem to have this uncanny ability to predict things. But what I also think is, though, is much like a magician, are they just really good at reading people?
I'm sure some of them are. Some of them are going to be. It's like anything else. There's going to be some people that aren't legit about the whole deal. But there's some of those that there's something to it.
Yeah. It's scary how good some of them are. Well, after the break, Cam is going to tell a strange story about murder and mystery that happened in Austin, Texas. Stick with us, folks. You're listening to Expanded Perspectives.
Before we get deep into this story, folks, we need to kind of lay out the groundwork, like normal, of how we were going to tell this a little bit and kind of put you in the right mindset and the right mood for what was going on at these times. And see, it takes place here in Texas. You've got to think back to the time of 1836, March 2nd, to be exact, was the day that Texas declared its independence. It was a document that was signed by 59 people. And they all declared their independence from Mexico, and they created the Republic of Texas. And on December 29th of 1845, Congress admitted Texas to the United States. But in 1839, it was a site named Waterloo that was officially chosen to replace Houston as the new capital of the Republic of Texas. The name was eventually changed in honor of Stephen F. Austin, is considered the father of Texas, and we now have Austin, Texas. And just 45 years later, we get the servant girl murderer. What is widely considered America's Jack the Ripper is a gruesome and disturbing tale. See, the killer's name originated with the writer O. Henry, or also known as William Sidney Porter. He's famous as a short story writer, an author of one of my favorite short stories, The Gift of the Magi. This was 3 years before Jack the Ripper tore through London, and many believe that this too was his handiwork, but we'll get to that shortly. As for the servant girl descriptor, it alluded to the occupation of many of the victims. See, the vast majority of these victims were young African-American women employed as domestic help, if you will, in the homes there in and around Austin, Texas. Victims even include a boyfriend of one of the women, the child of one of the servants there, and who was attacked but survived her assault, and a pair of married white women that neither were servants. Now, during the course of 1885, there was a series of 8 murders. All of these were carried out in a very similar manner. These victims were attacked in their bed as they slept. They were struck in the head with an axe and then dragged or carried into the yard where they were raped and mutilated. Many times the axe used was left behind at the scene of the crime. And also left behind were bare footprints. As the perpetrator would remove his boots to make sure that he was quiet and stealthy as he entered. He was quiet and stealthy as he entered and exited the homes. The first victim, to set the tone for the time in history, I think it's best to start with this, that there were 4 lines in the newspaper before we get to this victim, and it was a description of Miss Molly Smith. Now, these lines also illustrate what was applied at the time of basic racial categorization. The lines from the newspaper read that she was a light-colored mulatto, apparently about 25 years of age, not married. She had been in the service of the family as a cook for a little over a month. The deceased woman possessed a high temper, and she had once spoken of nearly killing a man with a bottle. Molly Smith was born in Virginia in 1857 and was in Texas in the early 1870s. But on December 30th, 1884, she was assaulted in her home, and as I said, she was attacked with an axe while she was asleep. She was dragged from her bed and into her backyard, where she was raped and murdered. Walter Spence was there that evening, and he too was seriously wounded on that night. And then on the night of March 19th, 1885, there were two Swedish servant girls that were seriously wounded, Clara Strand, Christine Martinson. By May 6th of 1885, Eliza Shelley lay dead. Irene Cross was murdered by a man with a knife on the night of May 22nd of 1885. And in August of 1885, Miss Clara Dick was seriously wounded. And again at the end of August, the 30th of 1885, Miss Mary Ramey, 11 years old, was murdered in her sleep. Her mother Rebecca was seriously wounded. Into September, the 28th, 1885, Gracie Vance was murdered in her bed, raped and mutilated. Orange Washington was murdered during the attack upon Gracie, and Patsy Gibson and Lucinda Body were seriously wounded. In Christmas Eve night, December 24, 1885, Miss Susan Hancock heard an intruder enter her home. Lena and Ida Hancock had both gone to a Christmas party and were not home that night, and Susan was asleep in her daughter's bed when the killer attacked her, hit her in the head, and drug her to the backyard. Her husband Moses woke up when he heard this noise and was able to scare the intruder off, but Susan was severely wounded, and she died 3 days later on December 28th of 1885. That same night, Eula Phillips was killed. James Phillips, her husband, seriously wounded. See, James was asleep and Eula slipped out of the house, accompanied by someone that no one really knows who, and arrived at another friend's so she could spend a little time with her boyfriend. Eula was having an affair on James. Within an hour of leaving the first house, Eula was dead. Her friend May Tobin and whoever else was accompanying Eula were the last people to see her alive. All of the attacks occurred while the victims were asleep in their bed. Five of the women, including Molly, were dragged from their house and killed, sexually assaulted, and, like we said many times before, the axe that was used was left behind. It was later dubbed the Axe Man of Austin. Many of the murdered women, who were severely mutilated, there were even some accounts claiming that the bodies were posed in a signature fashion. There were even some accounts saying that some of the victims had sharp objects inserted into their ears. But despite all these similarities, not everyone was convinced that the killings were the actions of one individual, or even of one group acting together. Well, and it also didn't help that the eyewitness accounts weren't always on the same page either. See, some said that the killer's complexion was both light and dark. Other witnesses claimed that they saw a yellow man. Some said that he wore a slouch hat and described him as a man in a dress. There was even reports of more than one killer, that they worked in a gang, like a pack of murderers. And one local newspaper compared the violence to a band of Comanche Indians. But even after all of that, it still didn't stop the accusations. see Eula Phillips, the wife of James I spoke of, and Miss Susan Hancock, the wife of Moses Hancock, whom both were murdered on December 24th, well, both of their husbands were charged with murdering their wives. See, the defense knew what the police were hiding and trying to use to catch the real killer. Back in February of 1886, in an old rough saloon in Masonstown in East Austin, the kind of saloon you'd picture in an old western, sat Mr. Nathan Elgin. He was roughly 19 years of age and a strong and handsome African-American man. He worked as a cook in a downtown restaurant where he also roomed. He was married and had two children. His wife worked as a servant and server and lived separately at the residence where she was employed. Originally from Arkansas, Nathan Elgin moved to Austin in 1867 and had settled in Austin in Wheatville, the first freedmen's settlement in Austin. And in 1882, Nathan married the beautiful Sally Wheat, daughter of James Wheat, whom Wheatville was named after. But in 1881, he was arrested for carrying a pistol and getting into a little bit of an altercation and then even exchanging gunfire near the governor's mansion. See, Nathan was evidently not without enemies, but he was also not afraid of a fight or of authorities. And in 1882, he demonstrated this when he sent a letter threatening the deputy sheriff and promising to whip, destroy, and kill the deputy next time he saw him. Now, Nathan was described as reckless and bloodthirsty in the newspaper, a description that, of course, would later be more fittingly applied to the events in 1885, but back to the saloon. A deeply upset and angry Nathan, fueled by whiskey, unleashed his rage upon a young girl. He yelled verbal abuse upon her, as well as physical punishment from his muscular frame. She cried for help, even begging through her sobs and screams of pain and terror at what would come next. But no one did a thing, all of them knowing Nathan and his temperament, and not wanting to have him turn his rage upon them. No, they all stood and watched as he dragged her from the saloon and into a nearby house. The screams and pleading, accompanied by the sounds of violence, could be heard from the street. The commotion inside the tiny wooden shack finally disturbed the neighborhood, and a man fled from his home in order to get the police. Police officer John Bracken arrived first on the scene, and accompanied by the saloon keeper, Mr. Dick Rogers, and that helpful neighbor, Claiby Hawkins. Claiby, without hesitation, ran inside to stop Nathan from killing that helpless young girl. Officer Bracken waited outside to subdue Nathan if he ran, while Dick Rogers joined Hawkins in storming the house and trying to pull the man off the girl. Nathan, startled by the interruption, quickly spun on them, and with the look of a wild animal backed into a corner, he pulled his long carving knife and stepped towards the two men. As Rogers and Hawkins, knowing they were fighting for their lives, both locked onto Nathan, a fight ensued, and Officer Bracken joined in, brandishing the handcuffs. But Nathan would not and did not go out easy. He threw off Rogers and Hawkins and placed a strong front kick to the chest of Bracken, knocking him off his feet. And as Bracken tried to recover, he heard a single shot ring out through the night air. It is then when Bracken drew his pistol and fired back in Nathan's direction. Officer Bracken's shot brought Nathan down in a pile outside the front steps of the tiny house, lying motionless in the cold, damp soil. But Nathan wasn't dead. There was no explanation for what caused Nathan Elgin's rage at the girl named Julia, but Bracken's shot paralyzed and mortally wounded Nathan, and he died the following day. Nathan Elgin passed without ever accounting for his actions. and a subsequent autopsy revealed that Officer Bracken's bullet had pierced and lodged in Elgin's spine, which of course accounted for his paralysis. The doctors had also noticed another detail. The detail that I had said the defense attorneys knew and the police and prosecutors didn't want released. See, those bloody floorboards weren't the only sign. See, during the investigations of these crimes, the authorities had carefully noted the footprints, which were often bloodstained and had made distinct impressions in the soil as the perpetrator had carried his victims outside. Well, apart from general measurements of size and shape, footprints, of course, in most instances, are not especially distinctive. And they wouldn't have been much use to the authorities had they not possessed the knowledge they had. But the footprints left behind in these servant girl murders had one very distinct feature. One of the footprints, the right foot, had only four toes. It was during the autopsy that it was revealed that Nathan Elgin had a toe missing from his right foot. In May of 1886, during the trial of James Phillips, the defense attorneys introduced the evidence of the floorboards marked with bloody footprints that had been removed from Mr. Phillips' home after the murder. They were compared to the footprints of the defendant. They had him remove his shoes, inked his foot, and printed it in a very elaborate demonstration in the courtroom for all to see. And even though Mr. Phillips' footprints were of different size, the jury was unconvinced. They believed that the motives of jealousy and drunkenness that the prosecution brought forward was what convinced the jury to find Phillips guilty of second-degree murder. You remember Miss Susan Hancock? Well, her husband Moses was also charged. And when the case of Moses Hancock was brought to trial, well, he was broke. He had fought for so long that he had gone bankrupt. But a Mr. John Hancock, a former U.S. congressman, no relation to the John Hancock you're thinking of, offered to take the case pro bono. And also testifying for the defense, rather than the prosecution, was Sheriff Mr. Malcolm Hornsby. And during his testimony, described making a cast of Nathan Elgin's foot after his death, the significance of the missing toe, and that the similarities between Elgin's footprints and the footprints left at the Phillips and the Ramey murders, and his belief that Elgin was responsible for the murders since no servant girl murders had been committed since Nathan's death. But even after all that, the jury was not completely persuaded. It was 2 days of deliberation for them, and it was finally declared a hung jury, and the case was discharged without a verdict. The servant girl murders in Austin, Texas stopped after Nathan's death. But there are some who believe that the real murderer simply changed locations, and that the responsible party jumped a ship from Houston, Texas, and sailed to London, England. Of course, after a long trip at sea and needing to get settled into his new surroundings, and of course after a short recon of his new hunting grounds, that on August 31st, 1888, prostitute Marianne Nichols, the first victim of London serial killer Jack the Ripper, was found murdered and mutilated in Whitechapel's Buck's Row.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives, a chilling story. Very scary. I mean, you know, we've covered this a few times on the show when it comes to these murderers, these serial killers.
Yeah.
It appears that that's what was going on in the city of Austin. Right?
Well, that's exactly what was going on, is that whole thing, the way it was shaken down. And there's a lot more to this story, like there is in every story. This is one of those stories. I condensed it to kind of the idea of it, but I mean, literally, you could easily dig so deep into it that we could spend hours and hours talking about this whole thing. Because, first of all, we have to always take into consideration the time of when it was.
Right.
Is that was a real rough time for African Americans, because slavery was over, but it wasn't recognized, and it, you know, and it went back and forth, and then they still weren't treated equally, and I mean, it was not good. So they were still looked down upon everywhere they went. You know, I mean, even in the freedmen colony areas that they were settling, it still wasn't great. I mean, it was, they were treated terribly.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt.
So when it was, you can only imagine that, at least in my mind, that the officers of the time were doing a half-assed job at best, really trying to figure out who's killing these black girls. Because to them, it wasn't a big deal.
Yeah, I agree with you.
It doesn't seem to be a big deal until they killed the two white women. That's when it seemed to where it really went crazy. Whereas if they would have really got into it the first time, it might have been a lot easier for them to, you know, they may have saved a lot of other women if they would have went after it that hard the way they did with Molly. After Molly, you know, if they'd gone after when Molly got killed, it would have been a whole different thing.
Yeah, you're right.
So you can see the way this whole story starts laying out. Now, look, from what I've read and looked, I like the idea. I like the twist on the idea of it being Jack the Ripper. I'm not so sure that's what it is. What I'm getting at is this. It seems to me that Nathan Elgin was the man responsible for this whole thing. Why? I'm not sure. It's hard to find. And I'll tell you folks right now that if you're really interested in this, there's a wonderful book, and it's called The Servant Girl Murders, and it's written by J.R. Galloway. And if you go and look into that book right there, it is, you can find it, of course, on Amazon. You can find it on Kindle. They've got it everywhere. But it is a great book that covers the entire story. And I mean, he gets into everything and really digs into all the stuff with in the papers that was written and all that. But it does seem to be almost like a crime of the times. Like, you know, it was like, well, It's really not one of those things of where we really have to care about it, you know, or we really don't need to worry about it. But there's a lot more, too, that goes into it. Like I said about the victims, there's a lot of history with the victims that were in it. So it always makes me wonder this. I don't know this because I didn't dig into this whole angle, but it makes me wonder, did Nathan know these victims outside? Was there a link between that? You know, that's what I've often wondered. Was there a link between all these women that he killed? Or was it just crimes of passion? Was it something? Because he was married and had children, but the children with his wife lived with her in one home, and then he lived where he worked.
Right.
Because they couldn't afford to have a place of their own, or there was no place for them to have a place on their own. So they were there in Austin trying to make a life for themselves. So it makes me wonder, did he work with these women? That's the thing, you know, like I said, there's more you could dive into it, but you're like, did he work with these women? Did he have a past with any of these women? Did he know them? Did he... You know, were they in the same colony, the Freedmen's little area there whenever they come up? I don't know. There's a lot more to it. But it doesn't sound like he was Jack the Ripper. It doesn't sound like that. But if you notice, the only place they talk about those strange bloody footprints and where they really know it was in the last two murders.
Right. Yeah.
So it's like other people said, a lot of this is hearsay. A lot of this is they didn't have direct proof of all the piercing of the ears. That stuff was added later, you know, things like that. So... could it be? Could it be that maybe Jack the Ripper, maybe this guy did a murder and then the real Jack the Ripper, whatnot, because there's some tales of a man that they believed was Jack the Ripper. And I mean, they've even tried to, of course, you know, trace it all the way down. I'm trying to remember the guy's name. I think it's like Maybank.
There's several people, though. I mean, even today, it's a great mystery who Jack the Ripper really was.
Yes.
And of course, every 2 or 3 years you'll see it. It's been discovered. They did DNA testing. This is who it was. But then if you look into it even more, they still are undecided.
Well, they've never laid it in. And I remember the guy's name. It was Maybrick is the guy's name. And it's...
Walter Maybrick or
James.
Something?
James is his name. He was a cotton merchant there in Liverpool. And they believe that they've added it up to when he was actually in Austin around that time, whenever these murders were going on and all that. And then he'd come back. Look, I don't know. There's so many other things. And we might ought to get into that. We might ought to really look in and do a whole episode or a whole segment on the history of Jack the Ripper and all the different angles that people have come in and talked about. But it was one of those deals that I think it was. My thing is this. Maybe it was Maybrick, and maybe he just happened to be here at the time it was going on, and he just took advantage of all the chaos. And he's just like, you know, that's what's we're going to go there. That's how we're
going to perhaps
go.
Both the guys were doing working simultaneously.
Exactly.
Unbeknown to each other. Yes. You know what I mean?
You don't exactly.
You got to think about the time frame and like what your forensic investigation was like at that time compared to nowadays. You know what I mean?
Well, like we discussed in the tale of them putting the ink on his foot and having him step out on paper or on wood or whatever and lay it all out. And that still wasn't enough to convince a jury.
Right.
And it's also because of how they were painted. I didn't get into in-depth because I didn't want to get in-depth on each character. Because it's not about the character in these stories. It's about the story in itself, of what happened and the whole thing. But they get into the fact of, like we were discussing, is the Elgin, not Nate, but the one lady who's, they believe that she'd been having an affair on her husband multiple times. You know, so you're just like, okay, so what are we talking about here? Not Moses Hancock, but we're... That's the funny thing about that is Moses Hancock was an older fellow. He's a little bit older than his wife.
Right.
So you start looking at that, you're like, okay, well, what's the heck's going on? It doesn't appear to be that Moses had anything to do with his wife's murder whatsoever. But, you know, you never, like we always laugh about, you never can tell about these. But it was Miss Phillips. Eula Phillips and her husband had... James had been through some rough and rocky times is when I dug into it. And I mean, like I touched on a little bit, but I mean like where she had left him. And back in that time, it really was kind of frowned upon, right?
Right.
It wasn't commonplace like it is now, as far as people separating and things like that. And she had been known to have multiple relationships outside of her marriage. And James was known to be a drinker. So it was almost like, okay, maybe he got a little bit drunk and, you know, and tracked her down and killed her. And that's the reason I think that he was actually the one sentenced. You know, Hancock wasn't sentenced at all. He was a hung jury. They dismissed him. They sentenced James with second degree murder. This one to me sounds like it might have, because I can't imagine him. I can't imagine the perpetrator committing two crimes in the same night.
Right.
But it sounds like to me that maybe James Phillips snuck out of his house and then went and watched his wife and saw what she was doing, and he'd had enough after he had a few drinks. And then after they left her and she was going to walk back home alone, boom, that's when he pounced on her. And it just happened to fall on the same night that there was another murder across town.
That makes
and
more sense.
And it sounds like Moses didn't have anything to do with his wife's murder because of the whole bloody footprint deal and that whole thing. But it sounds like James may have had something to do with his wife's.
I think so. Terrifying either way.
It is. It's crazy.
Speaking of terrifying, if you're really into Dog Man, like you were reading the Dog Man story there in the news portion of the show, don't forget August 6th. That's coming up. The Dog Man Symposium 2016. It's going to be held at the VFW there in Clinton Street in Defiance, Ohio. Now, don't forget, Defiance, Ohio actually had a rash of Dog Man sightings back in the year 1972. But if you go to this, they say it's a family-friendly event. And it's about $10 to $20 for the tickets. And there's going to be lots of cool people there, like Lyle Blackburn, Ken Gerhard, David Weatherly, Nick Redfern, Linda Godfrey, and Stan Gordon. So if you're into that kind of thing and you're in that area around Ohio, Defiance, Ohio, maybe you should go down there. Check it out. There's going to be other people there, too. Attendees telling their stories and what they sighted. And that would be very interesting to go to. I can't go. I have work and other things like that. But very interesting. I wish they would have it around here sometime. Maybe in the future they will. Cam, you got anything planned for the week? You're going on vacation soon, aren't you?
I'm going on vacation. Yeah, we're gonna head out Thursday morning, and I'm heading down to the coast. I'm going to do a little saltwater fishing down there. Yeah.
That's
get my kayak out.
I was just watching E60 on SportsCenter last night, and they were doing a profile of a surfer, and they were showing a great white shark attacking him.
Oh, yeah, great.
And I was thinking, that's Cam next week.
I saw a picture somebody had sent me of a guy that got attacked by, like, a crocodile or something while he was out there surfing.
So
I'm like, man, looks like they hate surfers. Y'all might want to watch out if you're a surfer. Looks like all the water, the animals in the water hate y'all, so be real careful.
I've seen kayakers being turned over by sharks,
too.
No,
you haven't.
Yeah. No, you want me to send you some videos?
No. Yeah, you haven't seen that.
No, I've seen it.
No, you haven't seen that.
Yeah, I can't. I look forward to seeing the photographs from your trip. Very cool. As far as me, We got about, let's see, 2 or 3 weeks until school starts.
Yep.
Summer's almost over. I'm going on vacation the following week. We're going to go down to Schlitterbahn with the Bruds.
Uh-oh.
Do some tubing and swimming and stuff. So that'll be cool. But don't fret, people. There still will be an episode out, even though Cam is gone for vacation. So you don't have to worry about that. Please, if you would like to share your story with Expanded Perspectives, you can email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. As always, you can call the show 817-945-3828, where you can share your story or tell others why they should be listening to Expanded Perspectives, and you might hear your voice during one of our breaks. That's about it for this show. For all you elite members, we'll be speaking to you on Thursday. For everybody else, take care. For Pretty Lights, Inner Tradition Books, New Page Books, Warwick & Associates, Llewellyn Books, and Ancient American Magazine, I'm Kyle Filson, and he's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.